in that case, I'll just go ahead, and I would introduce it for him by name, but you know me.
Testing. Good afternoon. My name is Ron Eves. I came from Portugal. I'm here in this panel basically to speak a bit of what was our experience with the implementation of the UCD, how it relates to DRM, and what strange protection we have for DRM in the Portuguese law. Probably someone could do it better than me, but DRM in here, for me, it's basically, there are two limits for what you can do with a work provided by copyright, which is basically either you can distribute it as you can nowadays and use it as you can nowadays, or you have no privacy and someone else controls completely your access to the work. DRM comes as a middle ground between that, because basically the other word is too expensive for the content providers to pay for it. So they prefer the solution that we all pay for it. So you find situations like the recent Sony rootkit fiasco, where too many people just said, no, you can't control our computers. We'd like to keep the control for ourselves. Unfortunately, it doesn't really always happen like that, so we'll have to learn how the hell we can fight that back, and we can keep control over what we pay for, not what others expect us to pay for them to use. About the Portuguese protection, I say that it's a little bit strange because there were two amendments to the original proposal. The original proposal had a direct implementation, created a law that was just a translation of the directive. Then there were some changes, and we participated in the legislative process there, and we got one amendment in the definition of DRM, where we basically said what we defended was, well, DRM basically reduces the market for the works because it has to work on that specific machines that support this mechanism. So we want the intellectual creator to have something to say about it, because basically he's the one who will be paying for it, because he has there will be less sales automatically if he uses such a mechanism. There was another amendment that is a little stranger for those who want a DRM. I have the law in front of me, so I don't say any mistakes, so I'm going to translate it on the fly. Basically, what it says is that a technical protection measure is not, as such, a protocol, a format, an algorithm, a cryptography method, a codification method, or a transforming method. I know where this one came from. We didn't propose it. At the time, we were stupid enough to think that this would never be approved. We were wrong, fortunately. What basically this says is that any form of implementing a DRM can't be legally used to implement a DRM, which is a nice standard, and I guess that sooner or later this will be fixed when someone notices it. Nobody did so far. This amendment, I call it, because not only because of the specificity of it, but basically because it tells us something, that is, it's easy to do something in this regard in terms of public lobbying. This amendment started with a French guy called Loïc Dacquery, who basically built a website about the UCD with proposals of amendments. We had a member of the Portuguese Parliament that went to that site and took that amendment and put it into law. And that amendment was approved in the Portuguese process, making it into law. So basically we have one of the few cases I've ever seen where building a website with something resulted in a change to law, with no other effect in the middle. So, people, for those who think lobbying is art, if you know how to build a website, that might be just enough. And I'll finish for here. You can have questions later.
I think Harold and I are primarily going to talk about enforcement. So if someone else has comments on the DRM stuff before we move into that, we should probably do that.
Yeah, I have a very short, small comment. It's like, under which license was Loic's website where he copied the proposal from?
I don't know how things work in Portugal, but in the United States, all laws, no matter their origin, are effectively in the public domain, which means that if some company writes a set of laws and proposes it and says, you know, you can pay for this set of laws, and then a municipality adopts that set of laws, those laws then go into the public domain. There's a famous case about it. So if no one else is going to say more on DRM, go ahead.
I'm Malcolm Bayer. I'm a lawyer. I've been working with free software for about 4 or 5 years now, advising developers mainly, also university. I've been teaching legal issues in free software at the Open University course and also at the local polytechnical university. And at the moment, actually, in a project within the UPC, the Polytechnic, to create a legal portal, a legal knowledge site about the legal issues of free software, which is going beta in July and will be more complete by the end of the year. So that's my background. And DRM is, yes, it's a hot issue. In fact, in software, it's not that hot, because since the 1991 software directive, software has been legally protections, effective technical protection mechanisms on software have always been protected. So the new law actually only applies to non-software content, books and terms. Yes, it's a topic that has become more exciting, let's say, because of the push from the content industry to have these new laws covering other content, but it's been around for quite a while. I think one of the issues with the GPL, version 3 of GPL is it's true that it seems to be it's more of a clarification, a new area that GPL is getting into. Just as I say, DRM has been around for a while, so now it's been clarified because people have suffered the Sony rootkit issue. I think maybe because it's still in its infancy, maybe there's maybe some difficulties in the drafting of GPL3. One example, it says that no GPL software can be considered an effective technical protection mechanism. That's a statement of intent for the court. The court will only really take this into account if it's considering the license as a contract, and it says it's not a contract, this is just a license. So the court actually may say, well, I don't really care what it says, this system is an effective technical protection mechanism, and therefore we will apply copyright law to it, despite what the license says. There's a risk. I'm not saying it's exactly what will happen, but I think it's an issue that has to be still dug into a little bit more to work in the way that I think the Free Software Foundation and we all want it to work. So I think that's the main issue, that it's a topic that's now become important, mainly because the technologies are now starting to appear. And that it's something that's going to have to put the legal mind and have to focus on to get something that's really valid and works as we want it to work.
Hi, my name is Matthias Plank. I'm also going to talk about DRM, of course. And since I'm used to giving lectures, I can't tell you how to buy a handicap I have.
Okay. 55 is actually here. Okay, I was asked to, I'm not a technician, I'm a lawyer. My background is really in writing technology, where I basically sit and write articles and argue with questions, which make me very unpractical in some cases. I want to talk today about one of my most influential authors on my stage, George Orwell, partly because he started a whole discussion about privacy and integrity in a way that many people can actually accept. He's also very topical right now between Barcelona. He's very connected to Barcelona. The city of Barcelona has rewarded him by naming a square for George Orwell, and they also have a sense of warped humor or something, I think, because the George Orwell Square is actually under camera surveillance, which I love. I mean, you can't, even if it's not true, it's beautiful. This is not really the point I was going to go for, but in the book, George Orwell launches the idea of newspeak, and basically it's the idea that you take away the meaning of words, and the purpose of taking away the meaning of words is to create control. And the example he uses in the book is the word freedom. And he basically says, in the future, the word freedom can only mean things like, this dog is free from lice. So this is the way we understand it. Now, who cares? Very nice intro, but who cares? Basically, I'll start with an article author. Douglas Adams wrote about technology. He wrote, any technology we experience between the age of 0 and 15 is totally normal. Any technology we experience between the age of 15 and 35 is totally revolutionary. It's going to change the world and nobody else understands it. Any technology we experience after the age of 35 is against the natural order of things. Once again, so what? DRM is not about the inability to hack our own stuff. You can probably hack it. DRM is to have a nasty side effect of changing the way the world is experienced. And in reality, it creates a perception that the social and legal limitations becomes a natural or a technical and a natural limitation, which basically means it cannot be changed because this is the way the world works. And that's what I feel most interesting about. Okay, thank you.
I actually just have a few comments about DRM before I move on to enforcement. I think what Matthias was saying was very excellent about the notion that the limitations of one's computers are natural. I think people think of computers as unreliable because they're used to Windows, which, at least in my youth, crashed all the time. I haven't used it. Maybe it's really good now. And as an example of this, look at China, which has these strong censorship type restrictions on the internet. And the Chinese people don't see it as, oh, well, I'm being censored, because it doesn't put up a big page that says you have been censored. It just doesn't work. So they say, oh, well, the internet, that's this flaky, unreliable thing with lots of broken links. So it really is a danger of perception that people will see this as normal. But to move on a little bit, the other problem with DRM-type technologies is that they make my job as an enforcer more difficult. I've been working for the Free Software Foundation enforcing the GPL for the past 4 or 5 years now, and I actually wouldn't recommend this course of action to anyone. I think if you're going to do an enforcement thing, you ought to do it for 1 or 2 years at most, because it's really changed my mindset. I now have an almost police-like mindset, and seeing as I'm into the freedom side of things rather than the law side of things, that's really a problem. Sometimes when I see that something is not a violation, I'm almost disappointed. So I would recommend not letting your mind get warped the way mine has. But the other thing about enforcing the GPL for 4 or 5 years is that you really get to see how much the social perception matters and how little the legal perception matters. For example, there's a common perception about the types of credit that the GPL requires. Notices at the bottom of web pages, et cetera, which doesn't actually come from any text in the GPL. It comes from the social norms of the free software community. So I had a case where some people came to me, and one of them said, oh, the other one is infringing my copyright, and the other one said, I'm getting accused of doing something wrong, and I haven't done anything wrong. And some person who I'd previously dealt with had gotten involved and, you know, threatened to have lawyers involved in everything. And I was in a really bad place here, because the guy hadn't done anything that had violated the GPL. All he'd done had been that he hadn't credited the guy properly. He'd credited the guy in the ways that the GPL required. But the ways that the GPL required were not, at the time, particularly robust. If you look at Section 5, subsection C of the draft, that's the section about certain kinds of copyright notices, you'll find that it's greatly improved from its GPL version 2 counterpart. But in this case, I decided I'll have a conference call. I'll get the two people involved, and without this third party who was threatening lawsuits and expensive lawyers, and he was in the UK, so he knew from expensive lawyers. And when they sat down and talked about it, they realized that, you know, the sort of credits that the guy was asking for were very reasonable, and, you know, it didn't matter what the GPL said. None of them discussed the actual text in the GPL, and I certainly wasn't going to open my mouth when they were being friendly. So I had this hour-long conversation in which I said about five words, and they just, you know, worked it out. So building this community of which has these social norms can be a much more effective way to get what you want than thinking about what's, you know, in this effectively dead piece of paper, this license that's, you know, legally powerful. But its power really comes from the social structures that are behind it. The other thing I found is that it's really hard to balance between being, you know, more friendly and trying to solve problems in a diplomatic fashion and using the power that copyright law genuinely gives you. And so when I started out, I was a lot less effective because I was very friendly. I never wanted to threaten someone to say, look, I'm just going to sue you if you keep this up. But now I say things that are along those lines a little bit more. You know, after the friendly negotiation is failed, I say, do you want me to write to your ISP? Do you want me to, you know, go to court over this? You know, you've got to get back to me right now. Answer my questions. I don't like doing this. It's hard for me because, again, my temptation, my natural feelings about this are towards the anarchy side of things. I'd like to build a community through voluntary action. In terms of the legal mechanisms of enforcement, I guess this is theoretically a conference about GPL version 3, so should talk a little bit about that. There are two areas where I think the changes have been helpful. The first of these is in the 5C notice requirements, which I've mentioned. And these notice requirements are useful because if there's a copyright notice in the software that has to be preserved and someone violates the GPL, I'll be able to find that copyright notice inside the binaries usually because they haven't gone through the trouble of obscuring it. And so having that and increasing the range of notices which must be preserved makes my job a little bit easier. The other thing which I think Evan and Richard discussed is the 60-day notice period. And I'm not sure how that's going to interact. Evan thinks that I think that it'll make our enforcement job easier. I think it's just not going to make that big a difference, honestly. I mean, it'll be nice, you know, from the point of view of a user of GPL software, so it'll increase uptake. But I'm not sure it'll change enforcement any. Harald, do you think?
I'll get back to that.
Okay. Yeah, actually.
Okay, two sentences about my background. I'm mostly a Linux kernel and network security developer. I have happened to start enforcing the GPL in a out-of-court and in-of-court way in Germany. It was never my big master plan to do so. It was just that I personally had strong feelings about corporations who were not following the GPL with code that I wrote. And so I ended up, in the end, starting the GPLviolations.org project, which has, in the last 2.5 years, enforced some, I think, 120 cases up to now. And yeah, anyway, so I'm a developer. I want to do software development. All that legal stuff is bothering me, and it's a necessary evil or something like that, which I'm not really too much interested into. But I started it, and somebody apparently has to do the job. But I totally agree with David. It affects your personality in a negative way. Anyway, to get back to enforcement issues and the GPL version 3, the removal of the automatic revocation clause, which in the GPL version 2 it stated that explicitly, if you violate the license, then your license is automatically revoked, and then the copyright holder can take legal action and so on. In the GPL version 3, we have the situation that there is a sliding 60-day time window, to speak in technical terms, in which there needs to be explicit notice by a copyright holder before you can actually start to explicitly terminate the license again as a copyright holder. At this point, both Evan and David have convinced me that it will not affect enforcement all too much. I'm not entirely convinced, though, that especially the lawyers whom I'm consulting with are having bigger objections, or no, objections is the wrong word, bigger doubts is probably also too strong, but reservations is probably a good word on the effectiveness. But I cannot really comment on that. I'm not into those legal issues too much. One thing that I personally find very satisfying in the version 2.3 draft that we have is the explicit wording on digital restrictions management when it comes to the GPL licensed software. Because as to my interpretation, and many other people share that interpretation of GPL version 2, it has always been the intent of the license to enable the user, the recipient of the software, to run modified versions of that software. And if you have some embedded device which only accepts vendor-assigned binaries of, let's say, the Linux kernel, then basically the user is no longer has the ability to do so. And in my point, from my point of view, it is a violation of the spirit of the license, not a violation of the exact wording of the license with GPL version 2. And I've actually been able, and David has just told me yesterday that he has had similar cases where I managed to convince in out-of-court negotiations GPL, informally GPL infringing parties, to release the keys or release whatever kind of mechanism that enables the user to run a modified version of, in my case, the Linux kernel. Even though the GPL version 2 doesn't have a specific wording on you have to distribute keys or whatever is in the version 3 draft now. But I think this is actually a way, a really big advantage of the current version 3 discussion draft. That we have explicit wording here, there's no misunderstanding whatsoever. And also from a practical point of view, if the operating system image or the software image, to speak in more abstract terms, is encrypted in some DRM scheme, then obviously it's hard to do the reverse engineering that is necessary in order to prove that there actually is a copyright violation going on. Basically, I live in Europe where we don't have a DMCA, but the EUCD. It's probably not as bad as the US legal situation, but I'm at least for what I'm doing, it's anyway. So I'm working while technically confirming GPL violations. I'm always working at the edge of the law because I'm basically doing reverse engineering. I'm circumventing a DRM mechanism in order to prove that my software in object code is actually in that particular device. And now the big question is, well, is it legal to circumvent the DRM mechanism in order to prove that somebody else has infringed on your rights? It's a difficult question, and the question gets even more difficult if you consider various aspects around that, which I won't go into detail. So anyway, I think that the DRM clarifications in version 3 are really a large step forward for the GPL. Thank you. That's if you have any questions.
Could I have one more comment on DRM?
Yeah.
I think another issue, I don't know if it's an avenue that the FSF has explored, is that they've ventured into the patent area regarding patent license and incorporating a weak or mild patent retaliation clause. One thing they might consider is a DRM retaliation clause. It's on the same philosophy. You know, we can't stop people exercising patents or getting patents, but we can try and revoke licenses if they make an aggressive attack at it. Same thing, we can't stop people writing DRM software, but if they actually take a case and they want to sue someone for eluding it, for circumventing it, then we revoke their license. I think that may be another way or avenue we should explore stopping or creating an area which is free of DRM.
I'll tell you, that's actually a fascinating suggestion, and I hope you'll put it into the comment system through the gplb3.fsf.org website, because that's definitely something we'll consider. I think it probably will not make it into the next draft, but possibly into the draft immediately following that.
Yeah, I also have to second David. It's a great proposal, and if I understand you correctly, it would basically be a situation where you say, well, you cannot like in a situation which I just outlined, where I need to do reverse engineering in order to prove that violation going on, that basically
I don't think it will help you. Well, yes, it will, because if the person who's distributed the DRM or the crippled software tries to sue you, he loses his license.
Yeah,
to distribute the software. But I don't think he actually loses his license to sue you. It's his right to sue you for actually.
Well, I've been threatened multiple times by large corporations.
It will be like a counterclaim. You know, the counterclaim is, okay, you sue me for circumventing your DRM, but then I'm taking away your license, or someone else is taking away your license, and I'm using that as a defense, so you better not sue me.
A company will only find out that you've circumvented their DRM when, in order to find out about a GPL violation, if they're actually violating, right? Otherwise, you'll buy the device and you'll circumvent the DRM, and it'll turn out that there's no violation, so you just won't tell anyone about it.
Good plan.
Well, and so of course, then if they say, okay, so we violated your copyright, but you circumvented our DRM, that's an argument that at least in the United States legal system is not going to fly. We have this notion of unclean hands. If you come to the court having committed a crime and, you know, someone has discovered this, even if they've discovered it through whatever means.
Yeah. Both parties have unclean hands, so they're going to be difficult there.
Right. Well, the other factor is that at least under the U.S. copyright law, if you create a derivative work illegally, that is, without the permission of the copyright holder, you don't have copyright on that derivative work. So, for example, if I create an unauthorized sequel to one of the Rocky films, and then the official company that's making it, I guess Paramount, creates another Rocky film with a suspiciously similar plot and characters and such, I can't then sue them because I never had permission to create my unauthorized sequel in the first place. Or rather, I can sue them, but I'm going to lose. There was, I think, an actual case of this. So similarly, since these effective measures only apply to copyrighted works, and their changes aren't copyrighted, it's conceivable that there's a missing cause of action there. Now, that doesn't help on the criminal side of things, but at least on the civil side, it helps.
Also, if you're actually given the rights to modify and the source code, it's a question of whether it actually is effective technical protection measure, and the law only protects it those that are effective.
Right.
You see many, at least in practical terms, those devices that I've seen that implement DRM, those DRM mechanisms are part of the bootloader, and which is not GPL licensed, and you need to circumvent the DRM mechanism of the bootloader in order to see the operating system image in plain text, which is GPL licensed. So, anyway, questions? I mean, as in, we can sit here and have a nice chat and...
Hi. Some people have been saying that the problem of DRM should be tackled in the content layer, not in the software layer. I was wondering if you can give an opinion on that.
Sorry, I missed a word there. In the which layer rather than the software?
In the content layer instead of the software layer.
Well, anything that purports to restrict what you can do, right, is ultimately going to have some procedure for deciding that.
Okay, sorry, to clarify. For example, instead of fighting DRM at the software layer, we should just make all our own content and ignore the existing content and, for example, move across to generate enough free content so that we don't need to use the DRM encumbered stuff.
The people that are saying that do understand that the objective of copyright in itself was to provide more works for more people, right? And that's copyright law alone. We are talking about copyright law was created so there weren't works that wouldn't revert to the public. That's why we have something called public domain. If people are saying now that we should just ignore that and start all over, it's basically because we got to the point where copyright doesn't exist anymore. And that's the meaning of DRM. In a DRM world, you don't have copyright anymore. You basically have access control to all works without any other rules.
Yeah. Code the law of cyberspace.
It's also a question of fair use. If the DRM is probably valid enough if it protects illegal copying, but it also goes too far. It's abuse, and it restricts fair use in different jurisdictions that have different names for this. But like private copy here we have in Spain. So the one issue is protecting things that fall into the public domain. The other is actually giving people their rights under copyright laws for fair use. So that they can actually use these content to create more content, which is basically, as you said, the objective of copyright law.
But John has a very good point here that there's this does count as a very major change in copyright law. And if we were to go ahead and just create all of our own works, what would happen is that they would just find a way to steal those works from us. Look, for example, at the recent broadcasting and podcasting rights that the World Intellectual Property Organization is trying to come up with. Just 2 days ago here in Barcelona, they had a meeting about it, where they claimed that if you were a broadcaster of a work, even if that work were previously in the public domain or licensed under a Creative Commons license, you got, merely by the fact of broadcasting it, a new set of rights to restrict other people from broadcasting that work. So to say, oh, well, we've stolen from you, but why don't you just create some new stuff? Well, you're just going to steal it again. Forget that.
Yeah. Another issue or a thought that I might want to add to this question of why not just create all kinds of free content is that, I mean, we also see DRM going into hardware, and once we have by hardware or software a combination of both systems that only show or display or whatever method of presentation is being used for the content, then you can imagine devices which won't even play anything that is not protected by a DRM.
Okay, thanks.
No more questions?
Yes, I have a question. The iTunes Music Store, which is very popular, the music that's sold on the iTunes Music Store is MPEG-4 AAC, except it has a little extension called FairPlay, which is DRM, and which introduces the nasty little provision that it will only play back on Apple computers or Apple hardware. And I wondered if any of you had a point of view to offer about this kind of DRM, which locks you into a hardware platform.
Starting again, basically, it's an example of the things that we've been told that won't happen. We have a situation where we have locking to certain hardware, which means that basically the intellectual creator of the work will see less money because you have a real reduction in the marketplace. You have users restricted from assessing works that supposedly are available for everybody. And it took what? 1 week to see someone publishing software to break it down? I think that not even that long. So we are in the usual scenario. People with a bit of technical ability are able to exercise their copyrights. People, the rest of the world is being controlled by whoever decides to use DRM. And the people that pay are the people that are getting controlled, or the people that are providing the real people that are providing the content. So it's one of the obvious cases of what's wrong with DRM. The other thing I would like to see is that normal people are starting to use software to remove fair play. Do you know why? Because they started seeing the difference of losing 20-30% more faster of their batteries if the file is DRM enabled. So suddenly you are seeing a backlash even against the supposedly more acceptable forms of DRM. Well, let's see what it goes in the future, but so far what we are seeing is that the examples we are seeing demonstrate perfectly all what we've been saying while fighting the UCD, and people are starting to see how they are paying for it in real money for not the creators of the content, but someone else in the middle.
Yeah, another comment that I want to add is that, I mean, we are now seeing the first couple of DRM systems. It's the first, you know, the first implementation, and the first implementation has always lots of bugs, and these kinds of bugs lead to those mechanisms being overcome quite quickly. But I think in the second, third, maybe even only in the fourth generation of DRM systems, we will be at a point where no matter how hard you try, you will not anymore be able to crack these systems. I mean, theoretically, technologically, it's possible. Just pointing to I think that pointing to the fact that, oh yes, those DRM systems don't work anyway is not really an argument at all for saying, oh yeah, we don't really have to take them seriously. It's to the opposite. I mean, we can be happy that at the moment there are still enough bugs in that software or hardware which allow us to circumvent it if we want to. But I think that's going to cease fairly soon.
I've investigated the technical framework called trusted computing, which we prefer the term treacherous computing for. And Harald is 100% right here that it absolutely does have to have the capability to prevent all sorts of access, with any break in the system being a break in the chip itself and being limited to that individual particular piece of hardware. So every time that you want to break a computer, it's going to be another X dollars. Looking at the game consoles, you can see that X has gone up. A mod chip for a PlayStation 1 was $25. A mod chip for a PlayStation 2 is $100. A mod chip for your own, you know, standard desktop computer in the future, or for instance, if you buy a MacBook Pro today, who knows what it'll cost? They're not available yet. Because what's happened is that the secret, that is the key, has migrated from the software, and of course if it's in the software then you can change it, to the hardware, where it is known to nobody at all except that piece of hardware. It really is a pretty major risk. The interesting thing about this, and I'm trying to spread this around in the hopes that eventually someone in the music industry will notice, is that the same technology which can prevent you from sharing music with your friends that you've gotten off of the iTunes Music Store can also be used to build a secure, untraceable file sharing network. And the way it works is the same technology of remote attestation. another computer can ask your computer what software it is running. You can refuse to answer, of course. You can always just unplug the network cable if nothing else. But what you cannot do is lie. Now, computers claiming to be other computers for purposes of compatibility has a long history. Any sort of emulator or Wine, which it claims to be not an emulator, but is, or even the early versions of Microsoft Internet Explorer, which called themselves Mozilla in their user agent string. This is a common practice. But trusted computing provides a way called remote attestation, which prevents this from happening. Now, imagine that I'm the developer of a file sharing client, and the music industry has their own specialized file sharing clients, which show the IP address that they're connected to. Now, my new file sharing client will say, I will refuse to connect to you if you are not running a client that hides IP addresses, and then encrypts all the traffic over the wire, et cetera, et cetera. So I wonder at the people who are pushing this technology what their real goal is, because this is, you know, a pretty major, would be a pretty major development.
I also want to continue on a slightly paranoid note right towards here. The problem is not only with the music and it's also the fact that once we start accepting this as totally normal, as totally acceptable that what we have in our home is not ours to control, we have a slippery slope, which is a bad kind of argument that we're going to do so much here. But basically, what next is the question you can ask. If you can't control your music in this case, what's the next step? And since we're just totally accepting it, as that, like now many of my students totally accept that of death in 70 years. I mean, that's copyright term. Why? Well, that's the way it is. We're arguing from a set up from a position of weakness if you want to change the way things are.
I want to add a little bit of more of paranoia. For example, this no, I mean, it's real paranoia that is based on real facts. The telephone I'm using, which also happens to be one of my pet projects in developing a free software for, it has a processor. That processor was released a couple of years back. And in the initial specification document, there were a couple of reserved bits and so on and so on. And a year later, Intel came out with an errata. And the errata said, oh, we forgot to document that that processor actually contains a trusted platform module. And here are the registers and bits for it. So, you know, we're already in a situation where we get hardware, and even if we get the full specifications and documentation of the vendor, there's stuff in there which we don't know and which we don't control because we don't know it's there. This is the current situation. It's not dreamland.
I should note that Matthias's argument is stronger than he thinks it is, because there are valid slippery slope arguments. This is an attitude-altering slippery slope. That is, that acceptance of technology A will alter people's attitudes towards future technologies of this type. So rather than simply stating that A might lead to B without a mechanism, Matthias has provided a mechanism, this attitude alteration. So it is, in fact, a valid argument. I encourage everyone who ever intends to make a slippery slope argument to read Mechanisms of the Slippery Slope by Eugene Volokh, which explains these sorts of arguments and provides a logical basis for them.
Also, again, I'm going down the slippery slope of thinking that alternative operating systems are going to be dominant operating systems in the future, and they may well not be. In this case, we're in slightly better territory.
More questions?
This is a question for David. I was wondering, can you tell us something about the defective by design initiative? This is something that, you know, because we're going to need to fight this in various parts of the world. So something has been started in the USA. So I'd just like to hear how that's going.
Yeah, defective by design is FSF's new anti-DRM campaign, and. I think for the first time, FSF has staked out what sounds like a moderate position here. That is, we're opposed to DRM, but we're not going to come out and say that we're opposed to all copyright or all copyright-like laws on media in general. Of course, in the software space, we believe that all generally useful technical information ought to be freely distributable. but music doesn't fall under the technical information category. If you look at a group like Downhill Battle, they're the extremists. They aim to utterly destroy the music industry by any means necessary. So Defective by Design is actually fairly moderate. All we want is to move back towards that traditional paradigm of copyright law without any of the new DMCA type, etc. But it turns out to be a pretty difficult case to make to the person on the street. I was at a small Defective by Design protest at the Apple store, the new Cube in New York City. And we had some people stop and say, well, what's this all about? And of the people there, I was the only one who was even able to remotely make a case, because it's so complicated to say, well, there are these restrictions now, which you might not find particularly onerous, but those restrictions could change at any time to more onerous restrictions. And at any rate, it's your music, fair use, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's particularly hard to choose a target like Apple, even though Apple really is at the top of this slippery slope in terms of attitude altering. Because first it was just this software-based, easily crackable, and not particularly restrictive fair play system. But if you look towards Apple's newer technology, every MacBook Pro has in it a trusted platform module that is a trusted computing, treacherous computing type chip. And the early betas of the most recent Macintosh operating system used this merely as a traditional hardware-based copy prevention system. That is to say, they used it as a dongle. They just checked if it was there, and if it wasn't there, they refused to run. But since the check for that was in software, of course it was easily circumventable. But it has the capability to be the full hardware-based, you know, nightmare scenario. And there is no reason to believe that future versions of iTunes, etc., will not start taking advantage of this once it is available in every system. So trying to educate people on this is a really difficult thing. And I think one of the goals of Defective by Design is going to have to be to simplify the arguments, explain the slippery slope, take people down the steps, and show people how they're harmed, you know, in the present rather than just in the hypothetical, you know, Werner Vinge type future, George Orwell type future. So I think it's going to be a successful campaign. Apparently, we've developed we've gotten a lot of media attention for it. And the Chinese Communist Party, I had heard, was very concerned, because apparently they're very into the idea of DRM, unsurprisingly, you being a totalitarian government. So, I don't know. I have high hopes for it, but I think it's going to it's going to be a hard battle. I think we're no more questions. So thank you all very much for listening, and thanks for coming to the conference. We really enjoyed talking to you all.